Corwin duly met Demetrios and got his permission to join Miki in the tech pit. Once down there, he got the rundown on the layout and settings, then was sworn in as emergency backup engineer, just in time for sound check. Caitlin noodled about with her keyboards, playing a couple of riffs not many people in the growing crowd recognized. Azalyn and Amanda slammed a viciously catchy guitar hook back and forth for a couple of minutes in a sort of sonic game of Pong. The rest of the rhythm section fiddled, adjusted, tuned, and tapped, while Miki and Corwin watched the gauges and twiddled the knobs. They were just about done with that when something at the back of the room, near the entrance, silenced the chattering crowd. Noting this, the band went quiet as well, all peering back to see what was going on.
I don't believe it,
Kate murmured, recognizing the cause of the disturbance as that cause moved forward through the crowd and emerged at the lip of the tech pit to smile up at her. Kyoichi Sayanji and Juri Arisugawa stood at the edge of the dance floor, dressed in outlandishly bulky leather jackets. Sayanji had on insulated pants, too, heavy boots and thick gloves. A scarf and a pair of goggles hung around his neck, and his face was bright red with chill everywhere they hadn't covered, making him look as if he were wearing a mask. Juri, who seemed to be dressed normally except for the jacket, had fared a bit better, and looked a bit ruffled, but not particularly chilled. "Hello, Caitlin," she said.
"What are you doing here?" Kate inquired, amazed.
"I decided I didn't want to miss your performance," Juri replied, "so I persuaded Sayanji to bring me up when his shift ended."
"You rode up here from Worcester on a motorcycle?" Azalyn demanded. "In March? With no CMF?"
Sayanji smiled a little smugly, his arms folded. "I have warm clothing," he replied calmly. "Speaking of which," he added, tugging off his gloves, "I need to take this stuff off before I roast."
"Is there somewhere we can put our coats?" Juri asked him.
"Come and meet Demetrios," said Sayanji. "I'm sure he'll be able to take care of them for us." Divested of his Polar Expedition outerwear, Sayanji proved to be wearing jeans, his black turtleneck, and his Maple Leafs jersey. As he returned to stage side, near the concession table, Utena spotted it. They both cried, "Leafs!" slammed a high five, and then bumped their forearms together, grinning gleefully. Wakaba and Juri both gave them very strange looks, which made them laugh.
"Kyoichi Sayanji and Utena Tenjo," thought Juri, "publicly displaying solidarity, even friendship. Oh, brave new world."
"Creepy, isn't it?" Wakaba murmured, seeing the pensive look on Juri's face. Juri blinked and turned to acknowledge her, but Wakaba was already heading back toward the bar in search of something to drink. Sound check proceeded, concluded. The performers were just making ready to quit the stage and get a last beverage before commencing their concert, when they noticed another unexpected pair of figures, these walking along the passageway that led to the stage from the rear entrance to the club. One of them was a human carrying a bass guitar. Not all that odd in a music club, but the Art of Noise was the only band scheduled tonight. The other was a Narn lugging a small practice amplifier.
"Mac?"
Moose blinked repeatedly at the young man with the bass and his Narn roadie. Speaking for the assembled Art of Noise, he asked,
"What are you doing here?"
Mac grunted, absent-mindedly fingering a blues progression with one hand as he gestured at Jacron with the other. "Jacron talked me into bringing him."
"And may the prophet save me from the folly of doing it again," Jacron groaned.
The others noticed the Narn's hide seemed a little paler than usual, though it might just have been their imaginations taking their cue from the look on his face.
Mac, you don't have a car," Moose rumbled. "You've had to bum rides to Boston more times than I can count, so how..."
"I do have a Cessna airplane," Mac smiled. "I supplement my income during breaks by flying bush for a friend of my father. By the way, do you know how hard it is to find this place?"
Yes, three people said at once.
Cessna, Kate said.
Were you that plane that buzzed us west of Albany?
Yes, we were, Jacron groaned. Had I known how insane this human becomes at the yoke of an atmospheric craft, I should never have given in to temptation. I did not want to know how many bridges a person can fly under between Worcester and Toronto.
Mac shrugged. So I like to fly. Utna pointed to the base and asked, What's that for? Mac smiled. Smuggler's trick. It's easier to get in and out of places if you look like you belong there.
Kate looked both puzzled and amused and asked, Were you planning to play that here?
Mac looked at Moose. Moose looked at Mac. Both of them looked at Kate and said, as one, No. They opened slowly, starting with a solo piece by Caitlin, haunting synthesized chimes pealing hauntingly through lowered lights and fog. That silenced the audience nicely, got them paying attention, and also puzzled them a little. Wasn't this outfit supposed to be a rock band? Any suspicions they might have had that they'd wandered into the wrong club by mistake were allayed by the next piece, a short, hard-hitting instrumental that brought all the other members of the band in, one by one, to overlay Kate's growly substratum and support Azalin's snarling solo line. Then, and only then, after each member of the band had been introduced, did they slam down their opening number, the same song they'd opened with last time they were here, an anthemic piece Kate called Higher Place. As the first set progressed, Kate stayed behind her keyboards, except for the songs with no keyboard part, for which she usually came out and used a freestanding mic so that she could get a bit more body English on her performance. She was wearing one of the outfits Jury had given her on her birthday, the one with a sweater that looked like a maple tree, and the Canadian crowd seemed to appreciate the touch. Miki Kaworu joined them on stage for Joyride, the old song they'd practiced and planned to cover on their last drive up to Toronto, and as Utna had predicted, he went over well. Women didn't throw their underwear at him, but she attributed that to his lack of the goth look he'd sported the last time he'd come to Sneaky D's. Wakaba briefly considered it, but decided she didn't want to run the risk of making him die outright. Azalin might be acclimating him, but he was still a delicate boy. For the next song, Kate came out from behind her keyboards with a guitar, her trusty, seldom seen on stage, black lefty Stratocaster slung over her shoulder. She went and spoke briefly to Azalin, who grinned, put her own axe on a stand, and announced into her microphone, Okay, gang, it's special treat time. Last time Caitlin here was in Toronto, she came here to Sneaky D's and caught a show by a local band you might have heard of, name of The Crush of Love. Widespread applause and cheering met this remark. This was The Crush's home turf, Sneaky D's one of their usual haunts. In fact, there they were, at the back of the room, waving and yelling. Azalin hadn't seen them before, but from Kate and Utrina's descriptions, who else could they be? Well, the meeting was kind of an inspiration, Azalin went on, so Kate's been working on a few things that you might say are kind of in their style, and since they're here tonight, she figured maybe she'd play 'em for you over the course of the evening. See what you think. If that's okay with you. More cheers, especially from the Crush of Love, who seemed quite delighted with the idea. Well, all right then. The first one's called Always With Me, Always With You, and it's dedicated to our very own chief roadie, the lovely and talented Utna Tencho. Utna, looking a bit embarrassed but game, waved from the already sold-out gear table. When she started playing, Kate looked a little nervous. After all, she very rarely played her guitar on stage, mainly using it to sketch out guitar lines for Azalin or Amanda, or give her bandmates a general idea of the melody of a piece. It wasn't that she wasn't a proficient guitarist, she was, but she generally felt that Azalin was better, and didn't have a problem acknowledging that fact. For these new songs, though, the instrumentals,
There was something deeply personal about them, something that she wasn't sure she'd be able to convey to Azalin, so that the Dantrovian could play them the way Caitlin heard them in her mind. That wasn't a problem with their more collaborative efforts, like most of the Art of Noise's repertoire, but these were different, and so she decided that if they were going to get played in public at all, she would have to play them. For her part, Azalin didn't mind. She knew how personal music could be sometimes. She sat on the edge of Devlin's drum riser and listened with a smile as Kate used the old strat to try to give shape to her feelings. Utna, sitting on the empty gear table, knew immediately the mood Kate was trying to evoke, and it brought a slightly nostalgic smile to her face. She would have found it hard to explain exactly how she knew, especially since she didn't know much about music theory or structure, but this song felt like Last Christmas Time. The good parts, not the awful, raw, frightening parts. The us-against-the-world parts, the mutual support and the power of truth. 3.5 minutes of a musical thank-you note from one best friend to another for having braved a very difficult time together. Wakaba touched Utina's elbow, gave her a concerned look, but she smiled and shook her head. No, I'm fine. The song left a tear in Utina's eye, comprehension in Wakaba Shinohara's heart, and a hush in the room. The silence stretched, brittle, a curiously moving moment even for those who utterly lacked its context, but dangerous, capable of turning maudlin at the slightest provocation. So Kate took advantage of the hush to put up her strat, go over to her keyboards, and sneak up on them with the piano line from old-time rock and roll, and shatter that silence completely. In that first set, they rocked the house in that fashion for 40 minutes or so, all told. Then, while the rest of the band took a break, Caitlin tuned up her board stack and played a few solo pieces, ranging from the simple but difficult rapid-fire piano exercise she called Rundown, to some more complex overlapping-line, semi-programmed stuff. While she did that, the rest of the band sat in a line, wedged into a gap at the bar, drinking Cokes and discussing how well the opening set had gone. They'd played hard for 40 minutes, but none of them looked tired, only exhilarated, and ready for more as soon as their boss was done showing off. Devlin Carter was about to say something to Amanda, but history will have to wonder forever what it would have been, because before he got the chance, a hand seized his shoulder, spinning him around on his bar stool. His right hand dropped into his side pocket, but another hand clamped onto his wrist, immobilizing his arm. Then a mouth clamped onto his lips, immobilizing the rest of him. When he was released, he damn near fell off the stool. Only the fact that Amanda was behind him, hands against his back, kept him from thudding to the floor. He blinked, stared, blinked again, and finally managed to sputter, "Rena." For his assailant, if that can be said to be the word, was indeed Katerina Dragonar. Her scarlet hair a little shaggier than when he'd last seen her, a broad grin on her face. She was dressed in a black leather bomber jacket, over a white man-style button-front shirt that was a bit too small for the bosom it was being asked to contain, gamelan navy uniform pants and field boots, and the blue skin of her chin still bore the mark of a helmet strap. "What are you doing here?" Devlin blurted. "Well, I just happened to be in the neighborhood," said Rena. Then she shook her head, still grinning, and said, "Nah, that's a damn lie. I'm on leave and I got lonely. Figured I'd stop by and see if maybe you and Skyblade wanted to fool around." Devlin went scarlet from the collar of his t-shirt to his jagged blonde widow's peak. Amanda put a proprietary arm around him from behind, leaning her face over his shoulder, and said with a rather conspiratorial smile, "Here in Canada, that's illegal at our age, Kit." Rena rolled her eyes. "Yeah, huh." Azalin crowded up behind them, looking over Devlin's other shoulder. "What's illegal, Amanda?" "Your favorite hobby, Azalin, dear." Azalin looked puzzled. "It's illegal to collect recordings of Narn opera in Canada?" "No," said Amanda patiently, then added with a parenthetical expression, "although it should be." Then, briskly, "Azalin, this is Katerina Dragonar. I've told you about her. Kit, my roommate, Azalin Devere Natashkin." "Oh," said Azalin, looking enlightened. "You mean that!
That's not a hobby, she added reproachfully. Then she smiled and added, It's more like a vocation. I stand corrected. Can I help? I think not. Aw. Can I watch? Definitely not. Darn. Hey, I don't mind, Rena interjected. You're kind of cute. I suppose I have no objection, then. The logistics may become very difficult to manage after a while, though, especially with just the one male involved. I don't suppose you brought Garen. Nah, he's out patrolling the rim someplace. And anyway, we'd have to figure out what to do with Cora, then. Hmm, true. Which would leave us with the same problem, only magnified. We could ask Moose.
Don't drag me into this, Azamuffin, the Hoffmanite rumbled equably. No offense to Devlin, I'm sure, but I do not get freaky that way.
Sheesh, none of you are any fun. I like to think I'm a lot of fun, Rena protested. Huh, Amanda? She does have her moments. Though those moments tend to be rather noisy.
Devlin, throughout all of this, made only a quiet, pitiful noise, as of a tiny creature which knows it is doomed. When they went back to the stage, though, after Caitlin's solo break ended, they took Rena with them. A hurried conference behind Kate's keyboards ensued. When the lights came back up, the red-headed Gamelon was behind Devlin's drum kit, and Devlin was out front, at the mic stand Kate used on the Songs Without a Keyboard line to keep her behind the stack.
"Ladies and gentlemen, we have an unexpected treat for you tonight," Moose boomed. "All the way from the glorious Gamelon Empire to take over the drum set. Please welcome the lovely and, I can only assume, talented Miss Katerina Dragonar, graciously freeing up our own Devlin Carter to take over the lead vocal duties for this next number."
Kate glanced back at Rena, who grinned. Then, as though they'd rehearsed it 1,000 times, the two women started the next song, Rena's hammering beat blending with Kate's urgent keyboard line, to set the stage for a cover of a 20th-century Earth song that Devlin figured perfectly summed up the state of his life at this particular point in time. Despite the enduring popularity of 20th-century rock music, not many in the audience had heard Tommy Shaw's Girls with Guns, and none of them understood the significance. But several of the sharper-eyed audience members noticed that it was the first of only 2 times in the entire evening when the rhythm guitarist, also a Gamelon, smiled and wondered what to make of that. Devlin took a break for the next song and then resumed his place behind the drum kit, for the evening's tongue-in-cheek playing of the Sionji song, as Crazy Train had gotten nicknamed within the band. At which point Rena joined the audience, and the band, restored to its normal composition, resumed the second set full speed ahead. One of the subsequent tracks was a full-on, old-fashioned electro-dance number, featuring sequenced everything, and Caitlin's voice run through a tone-bender to flatten, flange, and modulate it almost beyond recognition. After that came another of her solo guitar compositions, this one fast-paced and furious but upbeat, like a duel fought for nothing more than the sheer joy of the clash. At least that's how it struck Utena. A few more songs rounded out the second set, and as they left the stage, Moose intoned,
"If you can believe it, that's only half of what we've got planned for you tonight. We must be out of our minds. Anyway, we're going to knock off for about 20 minutes, and then we'll be back. Thanks."
They spent most of the 20 minutes deep in conference with Joe Groff, the shaven-headed, data-jacked lead guitarist of the Crush of Love. He didn't join them on stage when they returned, but Azalyn went to her microphone and announced, "Joe from the Crush wants to hear us do something with a lot of cool harmonies in it, which is fine with me, because I've been trying to convince Kate to do this one live for almost a year. And now that Joe's given her the gumption to play her acts on stage, she's finally agreed to do it. This is a redo of a redo, but we have a lot of fun with it. It's called I Think I Like It." She grinned, a little wickedly, and went on, "Kate's too shy to, but I'm going to dedicate it to our pal Miki Kaworu, the Lord of Time." Caitlin came up to stand beside her, guitar at the ready, and gave her a half-hearted little glare,
knowing that the stage lights would wash the blush out of her face and the audience would never know the difference. Azalin grinned at her, then nodded. Devlin slammed down a heavy opening beat, and they were off. The song was loud and powerful, but intricate. It had four guitar parts, Moose's bass, Amanda's strong rhythm, and Azalin and Kate trading off the lead line. The three women played off each other's lines with little flourishes and embellishments. Sometimes it was almost as if all three were playing lead, but for the rigorous constancy that Amanda imposed on her line, even when she was kicking down an ornamental frill or backing up Moose while the Hoffmanite and Devlin Carter kept the whole thing charging along. In their precision, their artistry, and their gleeful manner, they did rather remind their audience of The Crush of Love, though the style of the song was a bit different, less abstract, more straight-ahead power rock than The Crush normally did. That, and they sang. All three of the guitarists sang at times, both Azalin and Amanda braiding their voices with Caitlin's during the bridges and choruses. She'd never sung and played guitar at the same time in front of an audience before, but it wasn't that different from doing the same with a keyboard, really, and she didn't have trouble keeping up the feints and hooks at the end of the lines as she laid down the main vocal line. It was a song about the embracing of change, sung from the perspective of someone who was once confused but thinks the answer has now become apparent. Miki, down in the pit, smiled at the chorus. As he watched the rec levels and made sure all of the intricately entwined guitar work would be showcased, none of it overpowering or buried. Changes certainly had opened his eyes, and he suspected all his fellow Sephirians felt the same way. He couldn't see any of them from where he was, though, so he supposed he'd have to find out later, if he remembered to ask. After the second chorus, Devlin wound up and propelled the three guitarists into a round-robin solo, where each in turn took up the rhythm line for a bit while the others dueled. This, as she stood back-to-back with Azalin and ripped a searing solo line out of her black Gibson Flying V, was the second point in the evening at which Amanda Dessler smiled. They wrapped that up after a minute or so and slammed into the third verse without losing any of their intensity, then wound it down artfully with the last line and dissipated the energy painlessly with a few seconds of calm, gentle, three-way guitar harmonies, a little bit of extemporizing from Kate, and then a slow trail off into silence. The silence didn't last long, since it gave way to cheering, and Kate, flushed with the unaccustomed exertion of jumping around as a lead guitarist and singing at the same time, bowed, put her Strat back in its rack, and got behind her keyboards again for the rest of the set. By the third break, they were starting to get a bit winded, which Demetrius didn't fail to notice, as he brought the gang of them, well, except Dorothy, Cokes. "You kids going to be okay?" he asked. "I guess I shouldn't have booked you for the whole night, but who knows when you'll get back up here again." Kate smiled, slugged back about half of her Coke, and said, "Don't worry. We'll make it." "This is a good crowd," Devlin observed. "Lots of positive energy, what? I'm a little tired, but I've no intention of quitting." "Nor I," Amanda agreed. "Though if you're tiring, Earthman, you might ask Sniper to spell you for a while. She seemed to fit into the group quite nicely during your turn at the microphone." She smiled slightly and gave him a nudge that the others almost didn't notice before adding in a lower voice, "And you'll need some energy later on." Caitlin coughed. "I'll be fine, Amanda. Thank you for your concern," said Devlin stiffly, resolutely not looking embarrassed. At the end of the third break, Joe Groff took the stage for an unannounced, indeed unplanned, guest appearance.
The rest of his band hooted and cheered as he borrowed the Art of Noise's rhythm section for a performance of the Crush of Love's namesake song. Then, as Kate returned to her band, he stuck around to vamp up the dueling intro from the old Dire Straits tune Heavy Fuel with Azalin, before leaving the stage amid tumultuous applause to resume his station in the audience with his laughing, elbowing bandmates. Despite the fact that they'd been playing for over 2 hours now, the band didn't show any signs of slowing down. They rolled and sweated and grinned through 4 more songs before pausing to unveil a new tune they'd just finished rehearsing up to public performance standards the day before. Kate startled everyone present by doing the talking herself on the introduction and dedication to this song, a feat she was only capable of because she was, in doing so, specifically addressing a single person in the audience, as if talking to her alone rather than in a crowded club. "I wrote this song in Paris," she said, smiling a little shyly at Juri Arisugawa, who stood near the edge of the equipment pit. Juri looked mildly surprised, but smiled in return as Kate went on. "It's called To Be Alive Again. I hope you like it." And indeed, Juri did like it, though the lyrics unsettled her slightly. It was as if Kate knew considerably more about her past than she did. Unless someone had told her. But the only ones who could have done that were Tenjo and Miki Kaworu. If either of them had, Juri concluded, it was probably Tenjo. She was a natural-born busybody, which in an odd way was part of her charm. Miki was naturally discreet. It was one of the things Juri liked about him. And even his dalliance with Azalin hadn't changed it. But he had a bond with Caitlin that had to stem from something deeper than was obvious at first glance. So she supposed it was possible. Either way, it was pleasant, and at the same time a little chilling when, during the bridge, Caitlin looked straight at her and sang, "You're not among the fucking wounded anymore. There's a pleasant and a little chilling, but was it true? Well, she had endured 6 freezing hours in Sionji's sidecar for something tonight, and it hadn't been the scintillating conversation, impossible over the wind noise and the roar of the old Corley Titan's V-twin engine, or the scenery, invisible in the darkness, and, she was given to understand, pretty dull by daylight. So perhaps there was something to it? Juri shrugged inwardly and reminded herself that a rock concert was probably not the best place for introspection. Kate played another of her Joe-like compositions, a soaring anthem called Friends that she dedicated, through Azalin, to all our friends who've joined us this year from far away. Then she went back to her keyboards. Miki emerged from the pit to man the second bank of boards off to her right, and they finished up the show with, of all things, a heavy metal version of The Carol of the Bells. Azalin explained that they were playing a Christmas song in March because Kate liked it, because it's the only Christmas carol any of us can think of in a minor key. It was nearly midnight, and yet the band still had a spark of energy left in them. As they gathered backstage and listened to the still cheering audience, Kate beamed around at her winded, grinning bandmates.
What do you think? She asked them. One more?
Amanda gave a little sigh, surveyed her left hand, and said with affected glumness, "I am prepared to die for the honor of rock if you decree it, bandleader." Azalin grinned and punched her in the shoulder. "You sure you don't want my help later?" "We'll see," said Amanda with a smile. "Don't I get a vote?" Devlin wondered. "Gamelon," Amanda informed him pleasantly, "is not a democracy."
"Let's do it," rumbled Moose.
"Okay," said Kate. "Well, let's do red balloons.
Kind of a funny note to end a concert on, Moose mused.
I like it, said Azalin. If they're thinking, it'll remind them that life isn't all fun and games, and it still rocks the house as a closer.
Amanda nodded. I must concur with the rodent.
Whatever you decide, lads, I'm just happy to be here, said Devlin in his airiest Ringo Starr.
Okay, said Moose. I'm game.
They went back out. The crowd had good instincts. Nobody had left yet.
Okay, said Azalin cheery. One more. This one's old, but we think you'll like what we've done with it.
They started out pretty quietly, with the guitars kind of bell-like, and Devlin just doing some quiet brushy things to his snare. Then the guitars slowly built from a simple picked rhythm behind Kate, as she went to the freestanding mic and sang in her sweetest voice.
You and I in a little toy shop, buy a bag of balloons with the money we've got, set them free at the break of dawn, till one by one they were gone. Back at base, box in the software, flash the message, something's out there, floating in the summer sky, 99 red balloons go by.
And just as she hit bye, her band slammed down the melody line behind her, propelling the song in an instant from quiet wistfulness to a driving snarl. She let them play through it, almost dancing with Amanda as she powered out the rhythm line, then wrenched the microphone on its stand to her face and let fly in an angry rasp.
99 red balloons falling in the summer sky, panic bells, that's red alert, there's something here from somewhere else, a war machine it springs to life, opens up one eager eye, focus in hell on the sky, it's 99 red balloons go by.
Azalin seared through a high solo version of the hook, dumping Kate right back where she'd started.
99 decision straight, 99 ministers made to worry, worry, super scurry. Call out the troops now in a hurry. This is what we've been waiting for. This is it, boys, this is war. The president is on the line. It's 99 red balloons go by.
Again, the searing high hook, and then Azalin and Amanda joined Kate in another of the band's trademark harmonies.
99 knights of the air ride super high-tech jet fighters. Everyone's a superhero. Everyone's a Captain Kirk. With orders to identify, clarify and classify, scramble in the summer sky. 99 red balloons go by.
This time, Azalin didn't solo out the hook. Instead, the whole band gathered itself and powered through the original melody line again. Kate ranged here and there, grinning fiercely at her bandmates as they drove themselves to bring this last number straight over the top, and when it came back around to her cue again, she squared up on the microphone and belted out with all her might.
99, these creeks need to stop. Try some food, benzene, can it stop? Hier denn sie, hier schlaue Leute.
And then it all crashed down into nothing, imploding on itself in a single cataclysmic restating of the last bit of the hook, leaving nothing but a pin spot on Caitlin as she sang softly, plaintively, and alone.
99 dreams I have had, everyone a red balloon. It's all over and I'm standing pretty in this dust that while the city, if I could find a souvenir just to prove the world was here. And here is a red balloon. I think of you and let it go.
The pin went out, the stage was dark and silent, and a moment later, when the house lights came up,
the art of noise was gone. The applause began sporadically, as if the audience were startled and not sure it was over. But then it washed around the room, rising in intensity until it was like a gale-force wind.
"I think," Moose McEachern observed dryly to his bandmates backstage, "they liked us all right."
Jacron and Mac begged off dinner, Jacron citing a pressing need for Mac to be fully rested before taking the controls of his suicide machine and aiming it at the United States again. The rest were all jammed into the big round corner booth at Happy Seven. The Art of Noise, Utrina, Wakaba, Sionji, Juri, Miki, Corwin, Rina, the Crush of Love, talking happily, banging elbows, stealing each other's appetizers, and unwinding from what Caitlin maintained had been absolutely the finest show her band had ever put on. "And we couldn't have done it without Joe," said Azalyn, raising her teacup.
"Well, I don't know," said Joe Groff in his soft, mellow voice. He looked a little embarrassed, but Azalyn overrode his objections.
"No, really. Without you to ask us to do it, we'd never have played I Think I Like It to open the third set, and that song really gave us our second wind. It did me, anyway. I love that round-robin solo, and the way the rhythm section is integrated into the whole song. When it goes right, it really makes me feel like we're clicking, and it definitely went right tonight. After we nailed the second chorus, I could have played all night. Don't you guys think?"
"Hmm," said Caitlin, nodding as she swallowed her tea.
I agree. Bringing that one together is a huge lift. It's a gamble, though."
"Yeah," Moose agreed. "'Cause if we blow it, there goes our mood for the rest of the day. That's why we've never tried it in public before." He smiled at Joe. "So Ezelin's right. It's all thanks to Joe that the second half went so smoothly."
He rubbed an imaginary ache in his side and added,
"We quit exactly at the right time, though. One more song and I'd have ruptured my groove thing for sure."
"Speaking of groove things, Wingleader," said Rina, glancing pointedly at her wrist cron, "my time here is limited."
"Of course, Pilot Officer Dragonar," said Amanda. She rose briskly, placed her neatly folded napkin upon her plate, and said, "I trust you will all excuse us." Azalyn gave her a hopeful look, but she shook her head.
"Not this time, Azalyn," Amanda told her.
The Dantrovian feigned disappointment, then smiled and said,
"I understand. Have a good time. See you guys back in Worcester tomorrow. It was nice meeting you, Rina."
"And you, all of you," said the red-headed Gamelon with a pleasant smile.
"Come along, Earthman," said Amanda, and she started for the exit with her bodyguard at her heels.
Devlin could be heard muttering,
"Fear no evil, for thou art with,"
as he excused me his way around the end of the booth, then trotted after them. But he was smiling.
"What was that all about?"
wondered Domina Kelly, the Crush of Love's gravel-voiced, dreadlocked bassist.
"Gamelon courtship ritual," said Azalyn brightly.
"Oh,"